Hey everybody, this is Ethan Schultz, the Clean Cut Casual moderator and director. If you haven't noticed, there have been no podcasts posted since our most recent episode a few months back. I assure you though, no one has died, no one has been kidnapped, and we surely, definitely, positively have not stopped playing games. There's been a great deal of time and challenges we've been facing that kept us from our love of bringing you the newest goodies of the gaming world. While I'm busy trying to wrap up my BFA, we have had many managerial tasks that took priority and engagements that have made scheduling quite difficult. Along with this, we record the podcast together in person, unlike most podcasts done over Skype. So arranging days to meet up to do both gaming and recording is quite difficult. Furthermore, the podcast is unsponsored, meaning that we have to use whatever free space the internet will give us. And we are currently shopping for better hosting opportunities. Conveniently for you all, though, our lovely, lovely listeners, our podcast comes to you ad-free. But enough of the excuses. We love games. You love games. We want to keep bringing you interesting reviews and topics to better us all as participants in the gaming community. So I promise you, Clean Cut Casual is going nowhere. Expect more great media to come forth in the near future, including more reviews, more guest cast members, and even interviews. So with tonight's delayed episode, we discuss our experiences at the 2013 Gen Con. We also review Privateer Press's Level 7 Omega Protocol, and we also review Academy Games' Freedom. Thank you all for being the most understanding and supportive fans. We greatly appreciate it, and we hope to continue bringing you guys the most up-to-date information of what's going on in the board gaming community. Hey everybody, welcome to Clean Cut Casual, the monthly podcast about board games, card games, and community. I'm Ethan Schultz, the podcast moderator and director, and with me tonight are the two regulars and a new addition. If you guys want to go ahead and introduce yourselves, please.
All right, I'm Jorge. Nice to meet you.
Ryan Hicks is here.
Chris Bettinger.
Creepy Chris and AP Chaos in the standard trips. Yeah. And Jorge is...
Mad Borago.
What was that?
Ed Borago.
That sounds hot.
Oh, thank you. Well, that's my forum's name.
So. Okay, that's fine.
So Jorge is going to now be a permanent addition to the Clean Cut Casual group. He's a buddy of ours from the local shop and a recent... press ganger for Privateer Press, so congratulations on that.
Oh, thank you, thank you.
Woo!
Get us cheap stuff.
No.
What? No?
No.
All right, so...
That might be hard.
So, we know we've been gone for a while. There's been a number of things going on this summer among all four of us, so we decided to retire for a little while, you know, buy a bunch of stuff, meaning buy a bunch of games, and... especially in the case of Ryan.
I was going to say, Ryan buys a lot of stuff.
Ryan, who's at maybe like 30 games this summer already. We just wanted to do some preparing and whatnot, and that, and everybody had a hectic schedule. So we're finally getting back on track. We're going to be coming to you monthly now. I know it seems depressing. We've gone from weekly to bi-weekly to monthly. But monthly is the furthest spread out the podcast will ever go. More so just so everybody can take care of work and life and etc. So
being monthly now, it's going to take me 2.5 years to review all 30 of those games I got.
Yes, that is the... even if we covered two every single podcast.
So probably do like five games a day or something.
This game's great. Go. Your turn.
Yeah. So obviously, aside from the fact that we haven't been doing the podcast, we have been keeping busy playing games and buying games, of course. If you guys want to go ahead and give a brief explanation of your summer in the gaming world. All three, you went to Gen Con.
Yeah, definitely.
You have 4 days worth of talking about.
Yeah, definitely.
Well, we all went to Gen Con. We played a lot. We got all of the new boss going on in the community. For example, the Pathfinder card game.
Yes, three of us own that game.
Three of us own that game now. Pathfinder card game is great. That was one of the big buzzes at Gen Con this year, was the Pathfinder card game. That was one of the premier... games that released at Gen Con.
It sold out several times during those 4 days.
Yeah, and what they were releasing it like 2 months ahead of time, weren't they?
Yes. Yep.
Yeah, and that, and you got to get the
bonus additional pack like 3 months before it came out.
Which one?
So there's the add-on pack, and then there's the expansion pack, and you were able to get the expansion pack, along with all the mouse pads.
Oh, well both are out right now, actually. Pathfinder's out. Okay. You can buy Pathfinder in stores now, and the character add-on pack is out, because the character add-on pack's almost a necessity.
Didn't you get another one, too, though?
No. Oh. That other pack comes in the game.
Oh, okay.
They did give you a couple of promo cards.
Yes, they gave you two promo cards.
Yeah, the Fire
Sneeze and Pog.
And a sweet Pathfinder bag, your bag.
Yes.
Oh, yeah, the bag that they gave you because you bought
it.
$100.
Awesome. Yeah. But no,
I spent $100.
So,
multiple times.
It was $220 at the Paizo booth.
Yeah. Because he got me my copy, too.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
But Pathfinder was a premiere release. It was really interesting because there's a lot of different mechanics in that game. We'll get into that on a whole other time, though. But Pathfinder was fun. We actually didn't do a lot of events this year at Gen Con.
We canceled a lot of events.
We canceled a lot of events. Yeah, yeah, definitely. Because, okay, here's Gen Con 101. When you go to Gen Con, everyone on here should know what Gen Con is. But anyway, Gen Con is the big board gaming convention that's in Indianapolis every August. It's August, right?
Every August.
Okay,
every August.
It's pretty much like the if you know video games, it's like the E3 for board games and tabletop games in general.
In Indianapolis.
Yeah, and it's in Indianapolis, though.
Which is like our next-door neighbor.
Which is our next-door neighbor, correct, which is fantastic. But how many people were there this year, Chris?
They topped out at 50,000.
Yeah, 50,000 people.
Which is
there.
The most they've ever had, and it also beat Essen, which is the Europe.
Yeah, I think Dice Tower mentioned that they might have been Essen, so... Currently, those are the two big board game conventions, Essen and Gen Con. So they might have been
And
Essen.
Then, for people that were wondering if Gen Con was going to be moving, Indianapolis has bought it until 2025. So it will be there for many, many more years now.
For quite some time.
They like it.
Where were they considering moving it to?
It was just up. Else. It was up for bids. And they didn't know if Indianapolis was gonna.
Yeah, Indy was like, "Oh, well, we might not go to the Super Bowl anytime soon, so we should probably keep doing."
Well, that brings them more money then.
Yes, Gen Con is their most profitable 4 days if you don't count the Colts season. So if you count the Colts
entire season.
Yes, that brings in the most money for that city. If you would divide it by 4 days and 4 days against Gen Con would blow it away.
So one thing about our events, Gen Con 101, is that the convention hall, which the hall where you can go demo tons of games, buy a bunch of stuff, look at some new releases, you know, just a big expo floor, the vendor hall, that closes at 6, correct?
Yes, which I don't think it did last year, but maybe we just had events.
We had things scheduled much better.
Yeah.
But it closes at 6, so most of your events, it's very smart to schedule them after 6. Because before 6, you're wanting to go through that hall.
Or
no
even before 10. Some of the events are before 10.
Yeah, some of the events before
events
the hall.
Events go 24 hours.
Yeah, events are going all day there. So that's why we actually canceled quite a bit of events, because they were during the vendor times, and we really wanted to spend a lot of time
just
demoing.
One of them was
games.
Like right during the Fantasy Flight Seminar, wasn't it?
Yes,
it would have been in the middle of it, because
that's
how
Planet
long
Steam,
the...
which I still really want to play.
Oh my goodness.
Pretty much it's called... Fantasy Flight Games in-flight report, where they kind of tell you like a sales figures on, you know, how their sales were throughout the year. They also tell you how sales were the previous year, and just what new products are coming out. All the new products that Fantasy Flight brings out, we get to see first in the seminar, in the in-flight report, before they reveal them on the show floor. So they actually have places on the show floor that they're going to reveal some stuff, but they wait till after the in-flight report, which is really cool.
They were showing off like the new X-Wing ship.
Yes.
This happened.
And Battle Lore.
Yes, and Battle Lore
second edition, baby.
Oh my god.
Eldric Horror.
December.
Eldric Horror was already announced before.
Yes.
That was a big game that people were demoing.
Yeah, which whenever that comes out, that will be like the immediate review.
They mainly explained that it's not going to replace Arkham Horror.
Okay. It's its sister game. There's a lot of different mechanics in that.
Yeah.
Really,
really
cool.
We tried it. It was really
I was
cool.
super
oh,
excited.
Yeah. You guys played it.
I didn't play it.
Battle Lore, we tried. Ryan and...
Which was very good.
Chris tried.
Very good.
It was...
Battle Lore...
Instant buy.
It uses the Command and Colors system. So if people have ever played Command and Colors...
It's similar to Memoir 44. Tide of Iron, maybe?
Tide of Iron's not Command and Colors.
No.
Okay. Tide of Iron's Battle Lore, Samurai Warrior.
And then tons of other, like, Command and Color Ancients. But anyway, it's really good. But what was one of the cool... Oh, for me, the Descent Lieutenants are finally coming out.
Oh, the models.
Oh, yeah.
And they're going to be plastic. But the Lieutenant Packs, for anyone who owns Descent, they're going to be cheaper than the other ones. They're like going to be like... going to be like $7 or $8.
Yeah. And bigger ones will scale with price, but...
Yeah, because they're bringing out the Dragon Queen, Valandra, or whatever her name is, from the first expansion. She's huge. It's like, they showed what she looks like. She's like perched on a rock, and her wingspan's awesome.
It takes up like 10 squares.
6 squares, yeah.
She's in huge. Other words, when she moves one space,
but
she's actually
only
covering 15
bucks, which is awesome.
And they come with special cards.
They come with special cards called Evil Plots. If you like a specific lieutenant, let's say Baron Zakrath, for example, which is crazy because Baron Zakrath's like the big bad guy of one of the campaigns. Baron Zakrath, you have an evil plot card, which you can put Baron Zakrath into any campaign you play for Descent. Like, you can summon him with an evil plot. But they also add threat tokens, like old school Descent, which I forget what the threat tokens do, but of course we'll get into that when all that stuff comes out.
We actually are currently in the middle of doing a Descent campaign. We're about 75% of the way through it.
3 quests left.
We will be doing a review of the Descent. I don't know if we ever discussed that, but we are going to.
We'll have
but
to have Adam with us.
We are going to do it with additional guest podcasters with us as soon as we finish the actual campaign. Thus, we can cover from beginning to end. Because the beginning, so far, we've been beating up the Overlord pretty badly. But the tide seemed to be turning slowly after the center interlude.
The first quest of Act 2 was rough.
Yeah. That was terrible.
It was rough. And it's interesting because our campaign right now is with Labyrinth of Ruin. So it's the second campaign.
Right.
Which we have actually played a Shadowrun campaign. So
yes.
It's good. So we have
two
campaigns. Lost the very you lost, yeah. That's how you lose. At the very end. If you lose the last final battle, you lose.
So
and they also announced the Lord of the Rings Nightmare Packs, which seem ridiculous. Lord of the Rings is relatively challenging already.
Lord of the Rings
they
is
also
a little
made it easier too.
Oh yeah, they're adding different things. Yeah, they're adding Lord of the Rings, the Living Card Game, is really fun, because if any of you know the module of Living Card Game, it's kind of like a CCG, you know, kind of like Magic the Gathering, but instead of you buying booster packs and getting blind cards, they release monthly expansions. So let's say expansion pack, like The Hunt for Gollum. If I would buy The Hunt for Gollum, and Chris would buy The Hunt for Gollum, we would each get the exact same cards from that expansion.
Right. Well, it's like Netrunner.
Yeah, exactly.
Netrunner, they just come out with small decks, and then it's like they all have the same contents.
Exactly.
And you can also see what the cards are before you buy it.
Yes,
by
so you can look
at their site.
That's another big thing. They partnered with another
card game company
where you can actually go and look at every single card before it releases.
Nice.
So you can see if you actually want to buy that deck, which is really cool.
Oh yeah, they bought that kind.
They bought that one guy database.
Yeah.
So Lord of the Rings, the twist on that is that's a co-op living card game. Where you play together, and it's really good. And they're releasing nightmare decks, which are like some of the most challenging missions that you can play that are just going to be impossible since Chris and I can't get past.
Stage 2?
And also the
second quest. And there's like 30 quests out now.
And also they're doing like the actual storyline from Lord of the Rings. So you can actually see different...
Yeah, so far everything from Lord of the Rings card game has been original storylines. So now they're bringing it out that you can play through the actual Lord of the Rings.
So if you want to go to Mount Doom and drop that ring in there, you can do it now.
Very cool. Let's see. Follow-up note on that. And for some reason it triggered as soon as you were talking about cards. Jorge and I, not at Gen Con, Jorge at Gen Con, picked up a copy of the new War Machine High Command card game.
Yeah, High Command is the War Machine Hordes card game. It's a deck builder.
Based in the Iron Kingdoms universe.
Yeah, a lot of people are describing it, several of the reviewers, including like Grey Elephant, like smash up mixed with Rune Age
I don't know, man. If it was Smash Up, I'd like it. So, I
mean,
I love Rune Age.
Rune Age is fantastic.
I think that's pretty accurate. Smash Up and Rune Age.
Yeah, the weird thing with this game is it's going to be kind of a CCG, LCG model as well. So you can buy cards and add them to your deck and make your own specific decks. So you can like fight other people. So it's gonna be similar to War Machine in that respect.
It'll have a tournament scene.
Oh, okay.
With it, so you can customize.
You can bring your loadout.
Not to go too in depth about the game is you pick a faction, one of the four main factions in War Machine when it comes to Privateer Press's Iron Kingdoms. Lore.
And then
out of each of those factions, you have an option out of like 8 warcasters, and you pick 3 of them. Each of those 3 have 2 colors marked on them that they associate with, and then each faction comes with 6 small decks that are like additional units, warjacks, etc., of each color. And then you choose 3 of the colors from the six colors total from the 3 warcasters. And then you build a deck out of that.
Oh, wow. So there will be a tournament scene.
For the smaller decks, you can change as many cards as you want as long as you have 20 cards per deck and you don't have more than three of the same cards.
So what do you acquire in the game?
So as when you play the game, you have your basic... There's pretty much you work from 2 decks as you play.
Okay.
You have a deck of the deck that you build from the box, and then you have a deck of basic resources. And so as you collect resources to your hand, you spend them to buy them from like a row, like Ascension, of the cards from your deck, and you buy them and add them to your resource deck.
A lot of Rune Age, okay.
Yeah, very.
Yeah, because Rune Age, eventually, you recruit your own units,
right? And then you have an option of like rushing cards straight from your deck pool out, but most of the time, usually you purchase them, add them to your resource deck, and then you eventually play them for their command or war cost. On locations like Smash Up, and then you end up just beating the living hell out of each other until you eventually come to a conclusion.
Okay.
Yeah, the locations give you a lot of resources once you acquire them, so you'll want to try to get them.
It's pretty fun. So far, I haven't been too happy with the game sitting at 3 players. I'd like to play with 2 players, and I'd like to play with 4. But I remember the one day we played with 3, yeah. it was on a weird tangent with the locations.
A lot of people have been saying it feels more like a 2-player game.
Yeah, well, the problem is when you play 3 or more players, there's 3 locations, so it's like, well, this is my area, that's your area, that's Chris's area, and then no one ends up fighting. Like, we fought maybe, 4 times in the game? Like, I feel like if you play 3 players, there should only be 2 locations, so that at least one player's always got to be like, well, I'm stepping on this person's toes.
That's ripe for expansions, man.
They put it very clearly in the rule book.
On top of that, they have Hordes, which was the 4 main Hordes factions, and recently Privateer Press just came out with the big guns package for War Machine High Command that's like heavy infantry, heavy jacks, and colossal siege engines, etc. So I'm assuming they'll come out with a complimentary pack for Hordes.
Yes.
Yeah, I'm not sure about the pack, but...
I'm assuming they'd eventually do like Rhett. Where I want to see them cash in is on mercenaries and minions.
They will probably have mercenaries.
Like even if it was like a limited like 4 or 5 colors for each and minions that you actually can physically use as additional cards in the original colors, like kind of like a general classification that you can mix in. But that aside, there's more to Gen Con we need to talk about. So.
Yeah, so...
Yes, how much more Gen Con we got?
Smash Up Cthulhu came out. The obligatory Cthulhu expansion. Also, they announced already, immediately after the Gen Con, that they're going to come up with more Smash Up. So, that will be coming.
We're going to be smashing up so much stuff.
Oh, what we hit on last podcast... I think it was last podcast. With our City Remnants review.
Oh, yeah.
Is it the last one?
Yep.
I talked about the game I backed, Myth.
Oh,
we played Myth.
Myth was at Gen Con, and it was fabulous.
It was
fantastic.
Very, very good.
At first, we weren't coordinating our moves very well, so we were like, this is weird. But halfway through, and a couple of store words later, we got it.
Well, Myth is interesting because you just keep doing stuff as heroes until you hit a... like a threat number, and then the game plays itself and attacks you because it's a cooperative game. Where most games were used to a lot of structure, like, oh, I'm taking my turns, and you take your turns, and you... Where in Myth, it's like, well, I'm going to do this to attack, that's gonna, and that'll help you to open up for the spell, and then, Chris, you can do the healing here, and then...
Well, I was not the healer in that game. I was
You're always the healer.
And if you start...
You.
I was a spellcaster. I was blowing up stuff.
You always play the spellcaster.
I was dominating.
Yeah, so, at least in Myth, what you do is, if you start doing too much actions, the darkness or the bad guys are just going to come after you. Whoever has the most threat is the one that they're going to go for first.
Because you actually generate threat, like aggro in an MMO.
So it's very different. It's very cool. The models are very nice looking. And they have other games coming in store that we didn't get a chance to play.
We
but
had no clue they were coming out with.
But impressive. So good job,
they're coming
Mercs.
Out with a 4X game. Like a space exploration game. They're coming out with a Mercs dice game.
Mm-hmm.
Looks really good. So
are they really Mercs dice game?
Yeah, and it looks good. And then they just came out with another Mercs Mercs pack. Mercs is a skirmish miniatures game. That's well, you guys talked about that with one podcast.
Yeah, we spent the podcast talking about miniatures.
That's good. We're connected.
And then
stuff.
That one guy that demoed for us was making a sci-fi game for Mercs inside that world. I think is what he said.
Isn't that game already kind of sci-fi as is?
No, like something separate that's outside of the Mercs world.
Alright, so...
Well, yeah, it was a sci-fi, the 4X game. Sorry, like exploration and everything,
okay.
Yeah.
Ryan, what was your highlight of Gen Con?
Oh, my highlight of Gen Con...
Do you want to say Karma Race, you're lying to yourself.
Oh gosh, we didn't even talk about Karma Race.
I'm assuming that's
Karma Race.
Highlight.
Yeah. Yeah, you guys should talk about Karma. That was your highlight, Chris?
Just because we didn't know what we were going to do that evening, we had five people with us. Jorge was volunteering at AEG from, like, 6 to midnight. And we did not have anything to do from 6 to midnight, and we weren't going to leave.
It was four people with us.
Only four. Richard's counting us, too, for some reason.
Okay.
I don't know why. And our other friend was just cosplaying. But, we just randomly sat down at a table looking at what we just bought from Fantasy Flight's vendor. Because Ryan picked up the new expansion for
Descent.
And we were looking at that. And we're probably in a room full of an endless amount of tables. And two people approached us to play a little game called Karma Race, which we ended up playing the entirety of the game instead of just seeing the first few turns. So
they were gonna demo it
3 hours. Yeah, they were gonna demo it so other people could see it because they were wanting to sell it because it was on Kickstarter. And they either enjoyed us playing or didn't care at that point. And we played the full round of the game, and it took us about 3 hours because we were learning and talking, and it was awesome. It was a good time, and the game was super fun. Ryan actually ended up kicking it.
Yeah, I ended up kicking. By the way, Karma Race will not take 3 hours.
No.
When it comes out. That was one thing they're trying to do, is to get it down to like an hour and a half. To keep it at that good beer and pretzels game. That's what they want it to be.
Yeah.
But it's designed by Board of Death, actually. Karma Race, pretty much what you're doing is that you are playing as hitchhikers, trying to hitchhike your way to the convention center, so you can get the best sweet item of awesomeness.
Because there's only one.
Because there's only one. You gotta get there first.
The art looks interesting.
The art is made by one person.
And she did it
For free. Well, I don't know if it was for free. I forget.
It was, like, for free at the moment. So.
Well, yeah, anyway. But she was friends with the designers and everything.
Yes.
But she did an extremely good job. But the designer's name is Luca. But Luca runs Board of Death, which if you've never been to Board of Death, check it out. They do some really good video reviews. But Karma Race, what it is, you're hitchhikers, blah, blah, blah. And what you do on your turn is that you draw cards from different stacks. There's vehicle cards, car cards, train cards, and plane cards. So, and when you get the draw cards at the beginning of your turn, you get to choose which stacks you get to take them from, and you get to look at each card you get before you decide on which next card you want to draw, which is pretty cool. I've never really seen that before. They actually get to see. But anyway, whenever it's your turn, you play a vehicle card, and that vehicle determines how you move. If you want to move on the road, or if you want to move in the air, or if you want to move on the rails. And then you can also play karma on your card. The karma is where the cards come from cars, planes, and trains. So let's say if I played a car that has 6 karma, I can first play a karma card on it. Let's say I play a card that's 2 karma. There's 4 karma left. So Chris could play a terrible karma on it, where like all of a sudden I don't move at all. And then maybe Ethan, you could play a good karma card on me, which is actually a good strategy, because if you play a good karma on somewhere else, you get to move your token 1 space on the track.
Yeah.
Which is pretty cool. But really, really cool. We enjoyed it quite a bit. It's a beer and pretzels game, so it's really light, easy to teach, hilarious. So that was your highlight. Jorge, what was your highlight from Gen Con?
Let's see.
Mine was probably buying a crap ton of games.
Buying $700 worth of games.
Yeah.
That was my highlight.
Well, I met Bruno Catala. Well, that was pretty sweet.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, Bruno Catala was great.
We met Bruno Catala. Getting a lot of stuff from AEG was sweet after volunteering. They gave us like this sweet board that includes Indianapolis and Ohio, parts of Ohio, for trains. Which I tried it the other day. It's really tense. Let's put it that way. We might talk about that later. It's every time you do an action that you have to do, you get something back in your deck, and you keep getting this bad cards called ways. You're like, what? I want to keep doing rails and stations. I have to keep playing them. So you just keep getting bad cards.
And trains is a deck building game with a board, which is very interesting.
Yeah.
Not just the board you lay the cards on. Like, things you do with your cards generate pieces that you put on the board.
Yes. And it's been released before, but apparently it didn't get that much buzz because
terrible.
Yeah. It didn't have that good artwork, and it didn't look that great. But now it looks great. The cards are great. And Myth. I'd say Myth was pretty sweet.
My highlight was buying a lot of games, getting a lot of good games for cheap, and getting to play Eldritch Horror and Battlelore.
Battlelore, so good.
That was really cool getting to play both of those.
What about me saying Exodus Proxima Centauri like crazy?
Yeah,
can you say it one more time?
Can you say it again?
Exodus Proxima Centauri.
One more time.
Exodus Proxima Centauri.
On that note, we're going to lead into our next topic.
One more time.
If you guys have any questions about Gen Con or just want to know any more about our experience, you guys are always able to get a hold of us at cleancutcasual@gmail.com, or you can get a hold of us on the Facebook or any of the four of us, because we all like the page too. On that note, we're going to lead right into a review of Privateer Press's Level 7.
Omega Protocol. Level 7 was a game that came out last Gen Con, and it was a semi-cooperative game. You pretty much played as test subject inside Level 7. The facility is called Subterra Bravo. You started on Level 7 because it's 7 floors. And pretty much what you're trying to do is escape the facility so you can stop being a test subject for this mastermind alien, Dr. Kronos. Because Dr. Kronos actually did experiments on humans and aliens, did different genetic experiments. So anyway, Level 7's done with. Those people escaped Subterra Bravo. So now Level 7 Omega Protocol takes place right after that game. You don't need to play the other game at all. It's nothing like that. And Level 7 Omega Protocol has miniatures to it too, which is fantastic.
Yeah, that was a great addition.
Yes, but here is the description from Board Game Geek.
Board Game Geek.
Yes, thank you, Board Game Geek. Level 7 Omega Protocol picks off right where Level 7 Escape left off. Wow. Redundant.
Good job, Ryan.
Thanks. The Subterra Bravo facility has been thrown into chaos through the player's actions and escape. And now the government has sent in top-secret, highly trained special forces unit to shut down the facility and eliminate everything remaining in the base. In Omega Protocol, one player takes the role as the overseer, while 2 to 5 other players take on the role of elite special ops team. The overseer's role in the game is to control all of the alien denizens and challenge the players throughout the game. The players are trying to achieve specific scenario-based objectives by exploring a map that's laid out at the start of the game while fighting off hordes of aliens that the overseer sends their way. Gameplay is based around adrenaline, which is the currency that the soldier players use to perform actions. They generate adrenaline to do things such as move, attack, and perform special actions, like activating an objective space. The generation also has a negative effect for them, as the adrenaline transfers to the overseer player, who then uses it to spawn aliens, create new threats, hurt the soldier's chances of success during the scenario. The more actions the special ops players take, the more resources the overseer has to work with. Characters in Omega Protocol are represented by miniatures, and each special ops and alien character has different attributes, powers, customizable skills, and equipment. It's 2 to 6 players, which is great, because a lot of games like that where one person plays as like a bad guy, the other players fight against them, they're usually 5 players, so that's really cool that it is 6 players. It's designed by Will Schnoover.
I met him while doing the queue.
S-C-H-O-O-N-O-V-E-R. Schnoover.
Yeah, while I was doing the queue, I talked with him a little bit.
Yeah.
And I mentioned something like, along the lines of, oh, it sounds a lot like Descent. And he was like, no, it's not like Descent. And he started explaining it. I think it's not like Descent. I'm a believer.
It borrows some cool things from it, but it's not like a clone version of Descent sci-fi.
No.
Yeah, which the category is horror, miniatures, science fiction. Mechanics are cooperative play, dice rolling, modular board, variable player powers.
Yeah. Well, I mean, just right off the bat to go on the point of it not being the same as Descent, Level 7 has the mechanic with the adrenaline of the physical actions you as a player take directly get added to how good of the actions that the overlord, overseer player gets to use. While in Descent, that's not... Obviously, the actions you take affect what the overlord do, but it's not like you are, like, exerting a type of resource that eventually gets paid to the overlord to do something.
At first, when I read the rules for the game, I thought to myself, this game sounds really cool, really interesting, but I don't understand how well it's going to scale with that many players. That was my major, major concern. Because with Descent, I'm keeping comparing it to Descent. It's something I'm going to do. So
Let's be real. It's like Descent.
It has tons and tons of aspects from Descent and other games.
It has aspects from Descent, Mansions of Madness, Gears of War, all those type of miniature combat games.
But as you look at board, it looks kind of like a dungeon crawler, just with sci-fi.
Yeah. Yes.
So that's probably why we're going to
I will touch on the components of that game in a little bit, though.
Okay. So I thought to myself, how is it going to scale? And I saw perfectly with 6 players. With the more players that are playing, the more adrenaline is going to be generated. So if you're playing with 3 players, you know, there's not going to be that much adrenaline, so the overseer can't do as much stuff. But if you know, if you're playing with, you know, full amount of players, the overseer is going to get a lot of adrenaline to do a lot of things.
Well, I think
really, really,
I think the adrenaline is what allows it to.
I think balances it slightly too.
Yeah.
For the players, because 6 is ridiculous. But that 6 player, whatever he was, Counter-Strike.
Yeah.
Was as a
well, you can choose your characters you want to play.
But there's only 6 or only 5 of them.
There's only 5.
So someone has to be that guy.
Yes.
So if you pick his talents that reduce your team's adrenaline, that helps, because I probably took 20 adrenaline away from you in that last game we played. That would have been ridiculous for you.
Yeah.
So you want me to do basic flow of the game, and then what I like and dislike about it?
Sure.
Okay. So basic flow of the game pretty much is that there's a timer phase. So during the timer phase, you move the timer on the timer track. So like the first scenario that we played, there was 8 rounds to the game before something called the crisis point was triggered. The crisis point is kind of like the end game. When a character gets killed in the game, they can respawn next turn. But during the crisis point, they're dead forever. Crisis point is end game. So after that, it's the planning phase of all the Spec Ops guys, of all the Marines, or Special Forces guys. And you guys get to distribute initiative cards to each other. So let's say, Ethan, if you want to go first...
Which I always did.
you get the 1 card. Chris, if you want to go second, you get the 2. Jorge, you get the 3. And that's how you go for the turn. No matter what happens otherwise, that's how you go for the turn. After that, you choose your stance, which is one component I really, really like. each character has three different stances they can choose. So, what are... I haven't played with the characters, so what are some of the examples of the stances?
Reckless, cautious, and then...
Sneak.
Which it's pretty much, if you want to look at it as like a first-person shooter, running, prone...
Crouch.
And then, yeah, crouch, then
prone. The assault hat prone, your guy...
You guy had sneak.
Right? My guy had sneak.
Because you were the movement...
Right.
You're the reconnaissance guy.
Yeah, the recon guy has sneak. The rifleman has recon. Prone.
So what? Reconnaissance, rifleman, team leader,
countermeasures have meditation.
Meaning everybody had two of the same, then one that was kind of similar, but that was varied among each of the different
classes. And what that does is they add to your defense for melee and... range, and they also give you the amount of adrenaline you can use, as well as movement, how fast you are moving,
and it also affected your it also affected your shield of quantity for melee and for ranged weaponry. So obviously, like if you were running fast, you know you were more easily hit by one type of combat than another type of combat. Along with that, each character's abilities also gave them a specific type of ability on top of it. Like, I think my ability was like something where it's like I can move once for free, like without having to use adrenaline, or some of them were made adrenaline costs cheaper.
Those are from the kits. Before the beginning of the game, you get to choose 6 points of kits. That might change in other scenarios.
Oh, it's kind of like how the Descent cards work, except in Descent you actually earn points that you spend to get, in quote, Descent kit cards that are like additional spells and bonuses. But this one, it's like, you get 6 points, these are the three different types of cost of cards, three of each, and you add up to six to get like an additional character.
Kits correspond with the character that you have chosen.
Correct.
So
there is one universal kit.
Yes.
And if you can play the game in a campaign way where you get extra kit points for each... mission, so you can keep adding to your character.
Right.
But the only bad thing about the campaign in this game is that if you lose any of them, the campaign's over.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
So,
because you're dead. That makes sense.
Yeah.
So, for example, the countermeasures guy has different kits that let him take adrenaline from the Overlord. The reconnaissance guy has the ability to move for free.
Move crazy fast.
The heavy gunner has the napalm, which is...
That was ridiculous.
That thing was sweet. And he has a...
Strafing fire. Heavy just destroys crap.
And then with every different stance, you also get an additional bonus. So for example, the team leader gets an ability that he gives extra dice for attacks to other people close to him.
And I think everyone's unique card, maybe, at least for team leader and countermeasures, was a +2 distance if you were using, like, your meditate card. So being around your squad in that game is beneficial to stay together instead of spreading apart, which is neat because a squad in real life wouldn't just split up.
So after you pick your stance, that also tells you how much max adrenaline you can have. So if you have a max adrenaline of 5... you can't take any more actions that'll bring you above 5 adrenaline. Now, after everyone chooses that, you take your actions. That's the bulk of the turn. So, if Ethan would go, he can do as many actions as he has adrenaline available to him to place on his sheet. So, movement, he moves 4 spaces, for example. He puts 1 adrenaline on his sheet, he moves 4 spaces. If he wants to move again, you put another adrenaline on your sheet, move 4 spaces. Attacking is 2 adrenaline, and there's a lot of other different things that can take adrenaline.
Actions, healing, etc.
But it's pretty cool how the board's laid out, too, because the board's laid out to where there are doors throughout the facility, and there's room cards throughout the facility. So whenever you get to a door and you take an action to open a door, you don't know if that door might be locked, you don't know if it has a jam, or if it's going to shock you. So that's really interesting. And also, when you walk into a room, you draw the room cards, and those things happen, which you don't know what the room could do. It could spawn enemies. It could be a trapped room. So if you're playing Scenario 1, for example, you have a 1 jammed door, 1 short circuit door, and 1 locked door. And then it also tells you the room stacks that you get. Those room stacks and doors don't need to be in the same place every time you play Scenario 1. So you can mix it up for the players. So you might be playing Scenario 1, and they think they know where they need to go, but you could kind of change up the scenario for them, which is really cool.
Mm-hmm.
So after you take your actions, it's the Overseer's turn. So the Overseer... and at the beginning of the... we'll get there. But anyway, the Overseer's turn, they refresh their dashboard. Their dashboard is a thing that's in front of the Overseer that has different abilities. Like, oh, if I need to spawn clones, I cost 4 adrenaline to spawn clones. Every refresh phase, he removes 2 tokens from that particular dashboard ability. Different abilities take different adrenaline and refresh different adrenaline and refresh different abilities. So after he refreshes, he gets to do as many dashboard abilities as he has adrenaline for. So he can spawn stuff, he can cause a cave-in, he can do a bunch of different things. And then after that, he pays adrenaline equal to the adrenaline cost on those particular monsters to activate monsters. So if a rogue clone takes 1 adrenaline, he pays an adrenaline and then moves that clone and attacks with it. Attacking is really interesting. So Jorge, let's say you had 4 defense for range attacks.
Mm-hmm.
And my clone rolls 3 black dice. I roll those black dice, and there's success icons on them that look like bullet holes. And pretty much I have to get 4 successes to do 1 wound to you.
Right. It's not a exponential where it's like if he has a defense 4 and I roll 12, I deal 8 damage to him. As long as I exceed it, he takes a wound.
Exactly, yeah. The more dice you add to your pool, the better chance you have of hitting that opponent. Black dice are okay. Red dice are the best. There's only 2 types of dice. And then after the Overseer goes, it goes back to the timer phase, and then the Spec Ops guys go again, and that's the point where all the adrenaline that they built up goes to the Overseer, where they get to take all their actions.
Yeah, so, that's probably my favorite mechanic of it. The fact that it's the action of the players feeding into what the Overlord can do. Because, I mean, there was a couple of turns where we were like we had to, like, purposely lower the amount of actions we took because we did not want to overload Ryan, who was the Overseer, with a ton of adrenaline to be able to just spawn dudes everywhere.
Yes.
In this game, you get kind of a mechanic for miniature gaming, which is facing.
Oh yeah.
That was a really weird one added into it. I liked how it worked, but... It's kind of odd.
It takes a while to understand, but basically, you have a cone of vision. When you're looking where you are looking at, you only have one facing, and you have this cone of vision around you. You can also attack adjacent to you, but you're not looking behind you or to the sides. You're looking forward.
Yeah.
So you have this cone of vision.
Each model has a little arrow printed down on one side of their 4 facings that points in the direction of where their facing is.
Yeah, so your team will usually include someone looking behind them, just in case. Because someone can start attacking in the back, and there are several abilities that let you attack beforehand. So once you see them in your line of sight. Another ability, another cool thing about the field of vision is...
I have the perfect way to explain line of sight in that game now, Ethan.
Okay, I was about to say, okay. If you want to know about line of sight in that game, look it up, because it's very complicated. But
well, the thing is that that's one downside about it, is that it had 2 pages like describing line of sight.
Yeah, line of sight was very bulky.
Where all they needed to do is say, count the number of spaces to your target, see which one is the shortest path.
If there's multiple
shortest paths... If both of them go through a wall, you don't have line of sight. If neither of them go through a wall, you have line of sight. If one of them goes through a wall, they have cover.
Right.
That's it.
That would have summed it up in a paragraph.
Exactly.
Yeah, that's exactly what I was going to go for. Yeah. There's also cover, which is exactly what you just described.
It makes sense because you're using ranged combat against each other. So thematically, it's showing like people... like ducking behind walls and still being able to shoot each other, like a shootout.
Well, it's like if it's the same distance, half your bullets are hitting a wall, the other half are
exactly.
Them.
So
Ryan was just ducking, by the way.
I thought of that long.
Do we want to discuss components?
Sure.
For me, the models, awesome.
Yes, the models are incredible.
Models are super good.
You always get it good. You're good with your models. We all play War Machine. We all play War Machine Hordes, etc. Your models are good.
What did they linen finish in that game?
The box.
The box.
Only the box was linen finished.
No, the tiles are linen
finished. The tile was linen finished, too.
What's the most important component in that game?
The cards, which they weren't linen finished, and they were also like a 50-pound weight, which is a similar problem they had in High Command. Privateer Press, print the quality of your cards as the same quality as your War Machine character cards, because I don't feel like playing with paper. That aside, the game looked really awesome. Thematically, it was great. The dashboard was a really cool layout on the fact that it actually had like grooved in sections to put the stuff.
That was fantastic.
Why was the dashboard the one that had like the locking pins that hold it all together? And then the board is just like squares attached to each other.
I still think the reason why I did it with the board is because they want to be able to do more things with those tiles.
Right. They didn't want to force it into a particular pattern, but it's like...
Exactly. But no, I understand greatly because we set up
the game, and then one person got added to the game, and we were like, crap, we need to move everything on the table, and you had to, like, physically grab each piece and move it while, you know,
I assume it might,
yes.
I assume it might be because you also have to flip the tile several times or...
Yeah, definitely. I understand why they did it, so...
I don't have a problem with the tiles. The cards,
the tiles are also noticeably thinner than Descent tiles.
Yeah.
I'll show you them side by side.
No, they are, because Descent's probably like this.
They're noticeably thinner.
Yeah.
Now,
They don't sacrifice theme, but they sacrifice the quality of
them. The quality of them. But the miniatures are awesome. Yeah, there's a lot of miniatures in that game. There's a ton, which is great.
They're not Descent miniatures, but they're good.
They're really good. Really good.
So
any other components issues? The dice are great.
The dice were great.
Dice are great. They're normal sized dice. They have indentations in them, so those are good.
Yeah, they work. They didn't roll terribly.
Nope.
Unless it's me.
Unless it's Chris, which is always.
It's really interesting though, because the cards in level 7 are amazing. Yeah, not level 7 Omega Prodigal.
Weren't they
linen finished
in the original game?
Yes, and they were thicker.
Were they trying, due to the fact that they... Well, what was the price point of the first level 7?
55.
How much was the price point of Omega?
90.
Okay. So
it's probably because of...
I was about to say, if they were similar...
There's about 10 punch boards.
Yeah, I was about to say, if they were a similar price point, I'd understand, like, why the quality of the cards went down, because they added models. But the fact is, they added $40 for the models, but didn't keep the quality of the original level 7, which was kind of... You know,
it does have more cards than level 7, though.
Right.
And
design-wise, the layout of the cards are very easy to understand. Like,
yes.
I was expecting, because like Descent, you know, like there's a lot of stuff that goes down in a card. It's a couple of numbers and symbols, but you know, there's been a lot of times where like, okay, which one's the knowledge symbol?
Yeah.
In that game, it was very easy to know, like, this is melee, this is range, this is my adrenaline. It was like 6 symbols, boom, you're done.
Yeah, that was it.
You know? So do we want to lead into our now revised new rating scale of 1 to 10, which it will stay permanently?
Sure. I will say one things I liked about the game. Adrenaline, fantastic. Miniatures were great. The theme is awesome. There's a lot of theme in the game, because with every mission it has a lot of fluff to it.
Right.
A lot of fluff to it.
It did, yeah.
But it's really, really good. I love the facing. I think it's really cool, because it feels like a shootout. It really does feel like a shootout. There's a lot. I love the room cards. I love walking into a room and things happen right away. That's really interesting. That's like old school Descent, which that's one thing that second edition I kind of miss a little bit of, is in old Descent you kind of explored the dungeon and opened up rooms, then you revealed what was in there. In new Descent, everything's already out,
right.
But it makes Descent much quicker. Definitely.
Well, that was the point.
Speed it up and make it good. And I still love Descent second edition 10 times more. But The scaling I do have an issue with in that game. I know I said before that, like, the adrenaline, you know, if you guys have more adrenaline, then I can do more things. Hypothetically, that's true. At the end of a turn, I have to discard down to 10 adrenaline no matter what. And the same room cards are in those rooms no matter how many players are playing. I feel like that the Overseer needs more room cards so he can get more enemies spawned right away.
Right.
When a room opens up.
Right, it's like the adrenaline kind of did it, but it's like, one player and you spawn 3 monsters in a room, you're like, oh, this is bad. But when we were playing 4 or 5 players who came into a room and it spawned 3 clones, we're like, okay,
boom.
Yeah,
okay,
usually other games go in favor of the Overseer. in this case, it feels kind of against the Overseer.
Feels a little bit against the Overseer. Not to the point
where... let's be honest, both games were really close. So...
not last game.
Yeah, it was.
No, last game it wasn't close until the last turn.
Until
it was
very
like,
last
turn. We need to kill everybody to win. And then we're like, okay,
I don't think that in the terms of the Overseer winning, it's a big deal. I think in terms of making it exciting...
right.
For you guys, that it's more dangerous.
Yeah,
like,
gosh,
there's so many clones on the board.
As soon as we got to the office room, it kind of dawdled. Because it was just like, well, there's a napalm back there, here's a turret right here, okay,
yeah.
We're just going to do what we need to do.
So I think if there's a way to where, like, oh, with this many commandos playing, you add an extra room card here, and an extra room card here.
Yeah,
so you just spawn more guys.
Yeah, I don't see a problem.
Because
with...
even though I get more adrenaline, I play 4 adrenaline to do this ability to spawn 2 guys. I can't use that ability anymore until it refreshes. Mm-hmm. I could use adrenaline on another ability to make it refresh, but then I'm spending like 15 adrenaline to do one thing. So, mm-hmm. But other than that, like I really had fun with the game. 2 groups we showed it with really enjoyed it. Had a lot of fun with it,
mm-hmm.
And I think it has some legs on it. It's a lot better than normal level 7. I'll tell you that much. I love this a lot better. So yeah, we can go to our rating scale.
And to the rating scale, 1 through 10, we're actually going to start with Ryan.
I will give it an 8.5.
8.5?
8.5.
Particular reasons why?
The scaling, you know, definitely. That's my major gripe with it. More playthroughs would really show that out, though. I really like the mechanics of adrenaline. I think that's really creative. I love the dashboard abilities. I think that's really thought out. Rolling to see if you hit a success, that's really cool, because then it makes wounds very, very bad. You know,
right.
When you take a wound, you're like, oof, I got a wound.
Right,
because
you get like 4.
Yeah, you have like 4 health.
Yeah.
And so that's really cool. Like I said, I think with some scaling issues, and also the commanders can spend adrenaline just to heal tokens, too. You know, I haven't seen that come into play yet, though, but I can imagine that you guys could heal pretty quickly. But I think it'd be a little bit higher if the quality was a little bit better with the cards.
Mm-hmm.
And if the scaling, you know, if, like I said, I want to play through it more to see the scaling issues, but right now it's a solid 8.5. It's really, really good. I enjoyed it. I love sci-fi games. I love the facing. So, yeah, I've already said the stuff I like about it. So,
yeah.
good job, Privateer Press. Keep making games like this, because this was... big upgrade. I loved it. It was a good, big, bold box.
And then we're going to lead into Jorge's rating.
So, from what I've heard before, I have not played Level 7, the original. I did play Omega Protocol. This is a hit to me, compared to what I've heard from the other one. Now, I'm not big into sci-fi, specifically, like fighting aliens, but this had a lot of cool mechanics. The facing with the miniatures... the stances were really cool. You choose your stances. The adrenaline was great. I think
it's
kind of
cool that it's like horror too.
Yeah,
you know, it's
yeah.
like you're in a facility underground. Like it's creepy instead of it just being like.
And it was Dead Space.
And
yeah,
one,
it's like Dead Space. Yeah.
One thing we didn't mention is once you die, you can still someone can still resurrect you, but you're wounded and your stuff's moving slower, and it's kind of like Gears of War.
And when you come back to life after someone resurrects you, you still have 4 wounds on you.
Right.
You only heal to 1.
Yeah, so you have to still heal. So this seems like a very tense game between the Overlord and the...
Commandos.
The Commandos.
Overseer and Commandos.
I would give this a solid 7, at least for me. This is a really good score. Not bad at all.
7's
good. So, just explaining that. It's a really good game. I really enjoyed it. It's really enjoyable. It has some really cool, neat stuff. And I can vouch for, while I was walking down that line in the queue, and I talked with the designer, I was a bit hesitant, but I can tell you, this is not Descent. This is something, at least, very different.
There's a place on your shelf for this and Descent.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely.
You should take it as a compliment if someone says it's like Descent.
Well, I think they don't want it to be like, oh, let me roll my plasma symbols, I mean, surges. to, you know, they don't want it to be feel like it's a reskin. That's all.
Right.
So
well, it's not, but
yeah. I'm hoping this has other expansions that bring it a bit to other levels, because I'm hoping they keep going with it.
There's three tokens in the game that don't have any use for them, and it says for use in the future expansion.
So I'm hoping that they go with that. So,
on that note, we will lead into Chris's rating,
which is also going to be a 7. Everyone said that what's great about the game, no one's really had any complaints. I really don't. Pretty much took everything that I like out of several other board games and put it into one. So they really didn't do anything wrong with this game. It's just nice. I like these types of games. So, I mean, it's awesome. The only thing they can make better is, like, Descent. I would enjoy a campaign. I would like to see a thematic campaign. Since the game is full of so much theme, I'd like to see something like
maybe
a big boss at the end that, you know, throughout the whole campaign you're trying to find him or something. Just something that has something that makes you keep going.
That's an interesting thing that you bring that up, because all the scenarios link together to form one campaign. So every single scenario is linked together. But I feel like you would be able to just play a game of this singular, like a single scenario in this, whereas Descent, you almost always want to play Descent in a campaign. Very rarely do we're like, oh, let's play a single scenario of Descent.
Let's play scenario 6 of Descent.
Yeah, so which is funny because that's how old Descent is. Old Descent was, you know, just played scenarios.
Yes.
But they're both good in their own right. But
This game is losing with theme.
Yeah.
If you love sci-fi,
this is
great.
I'd like to do a campaign with this to try it out, so.
Yeah.
Is there leveling in that?
You get more kits. Yeah, you get more stuff, so.
I guess we'll lead into my rating. And I liked playing the game. It was fun. And I like aliens. But I'm giving it a 6.5. At not saying 6.5 is bad. I'm just a freak about paper, and I'm a freak about card quality. Not even so much rhyme when it comes to linen finish, but it's like, if you are going to produce a game that involves cards, you need to make it a weight of cards that doesn't feel like you have to be careful to hold them. And I felt like that game, along with some of other titles.
So is that influencing the card quality?
Yeah, it is influencing my. If the card quality and the tile quality was better, I'd give them at least another point. Now I will say they can sucker me into jumping to a 7.5 if they create a level 7 card game, because that would be awesome. But on that note, we're gonna lead next into our review of Freedom by Academy Games.
Games creation. This is a company that is based in Ohio. I kicked the game, and they are gonna donate some copies to the Freedom Center down in Cincinnati.
Technically, it's part of the Birth of America series too, isn't it?
Yeah, it's a Birth of America game, and they're gonna go with the Underground Railroad theme. I don't think this. I'm pretty sure this is probably the only game. Board game that I've heard about this.
About the Underground Railroad?
Yeah.
It's a historical game.
Yeah. Which Academy Games is they're very well known for majority of the games being focused around historical content.
Yeah.
Especially historical content involving the state of Ohio.
Yes.
Which is where this podcast is from.
Yes.
Which is a win.
So, with the BGG description. Early in the history of the United States, slavery was an institution that seemed immovable. But with efforts of men and women across from the country, it was toppled. In Freedom, the Underground Railroad, players are working to build up the strength of the abolitionist movement through the use of notable figures and pivotal events. By raising support of the cause and moving slaves to freedom in Canada, the minds of Americans can be changed, and the institution of slavery can be brought down. Freedom is a card-driven cooperative game from 1 to 4 players, in which a group is working for the abolitionist movement to help bring an end to the slavery of in the United States. The players use a combination of cards, which feature figures and events spanning from early independence to until the Civil War, along with the action tokens and the benefits of their role to impact the game. Players need to strike for the right balance between freeing the slaves from plantations in the South and raising funds which desperately needed to allow the group to continue the abolitionist activities as well as strengthen the cause. The goal is not easy, and in addition to people and events that can have a negative impact on the group's progress, there are also slave catchers roaming across the board, reacting to the movements of the slaves and the board and hoping to catch the runaway slaves and send them back to the plantations. Through careful planning and working together, the group might see an end to slavery in their time. So, in Freedom, the Underground Railroad, you have two sides of the board. The board is huge. Let's start there. It's beautiful.
Sixfold?
It's a sixfold board.
It's huge. It's about as big as Dominant Species board, if you play Dominant Species.
It's probably bigger than the Dominant Species board.
And it's beautiful.
Yeah, very high quality components that game.
Yes.
So you have a side, which is like one third of the board. It's the political movement side. So you're having different cards moving in there, and that's where you can buy the movement, the fundraising tokens, for example, and the support tokens. And on the other side, you have the movement of the slaves. You're trying to get them into Canada. The rules are as follows.
Very cool, too, because the one side is like a newspaper.
Yeah, it's got the North Star.
Yes, and then the other side is the map.
There's no, like, normal ground on the board. There's not, like, this is just the zone for cards. Like, the zone for cards even has a theme to itself, being, like, the newspaper that you purchase, you know, actions,
cool,
etc. from. Like, there's no part of that board that's, like, just dead
this
weight.
This is cards.
Yeah, exactly, you know.
So, what you're trying to do is get all the support tokens. It ranges from different levels between players, so you can have less support tokens in smaller games, and get a certain amount of number of slaves move across to Canada. If you lose more slaves than you're allowed to lose during the game, you lost, and it's game over. So the way you're trying to do this is every player has a different role. There's a lantern phase, which is basically the player has the lantern. There's a lantern for the Underground Railroad. That's a team.
That's the first player token.
Yeah, it's the first player token. And then you all start buying tokens in order to move the slaves. There's a set amount of tokens that are for each game. There's no more extra except for the movement tokens. You get one back if it's the last one. For fundraising tokens, you're trying to get money in order to buy those support tokens. Their cost is $10. You start with $8. So to put it in perspective, each movement usually gives you like $1 if you move to a bigger city. Also, the cards in the bottom that you can buy during your turn. Once every player has all the tokens, the slave catchers start moving. There are 5 slave catchers. You roll some dice and see how many spaces they can move through their trail. So basically, they have one trail that they go and they just patrol it back and forth.
And most of them intersect on multiple points.
Yes. The board is set in the northern cities, the northern states, and the southern states. And then Canada, which is where you're having the counter of all the slaves being freed. Then every player starts their turn. They can use 2 of those tokens that they bought in the beginning. Support tokens doesn't do anything. They're just there to win the game. Fundraising tokens gets you money depending on how many slaves are in certain regions. So they could be in the southern states or the northern states, and they give you money. 1 money for each slaves that you have in those states. You can use any of those, or you can use a conductor token, which is moving slaves across the board. Every time you end your slave in a bigger city, usually it gives you money. Some bigger cities can hold more slaves than just one. You cannot
four.
Totally you cannot move to slave the catchers.
I totally forgot about that in the game. I was like so worried about only having one in each spot. I forgot the big cities.
Well, by the time they get to the big cities, you want to get them to Canada because the slave catchers are up there.
Right.
And
yeah.
It gets scary fast.
Yeah.
When you get to a city, basically you get some money depending on the city, and then the slave catchers move. If your city that you end up your movement in is one in which the slave catchers patrol, the rule, I'm going to go with what the rules say, they get a tip that the slaves are moving through that area. So they move closer to you, one space. So the slave catchers are moving always.
That mechanic's frustrating. There are so many times where we're like, oh yeah, we can move somebody here. And we're like, wait, no, that's on his trail. Like, if he moves there, he's going to move into somebody else. Like,
and they can piggyback on multiples.
And so. I felt like it was a lot harder to move through the left side of the board than it was to move to the right. Not even counting the fact that there's a boat on the east coast, but the west side of the board was a lot harder to get people to move.
Well, that kind of makes sense, too, because what the...
Well, most of their slaves are moving.
Washington
see, like,
was on the
there.
East side, and they were more pro, you know,
yeah.
abolishing it. So,
right,
that makes a little bit thematic sense.
Yeah, well, there was only two slave catchers that were like patrolling the entire East Coast, but there's like one of those, and like
west.
Three other ones are doing the entire West.
He's coming up from like Louisiana and stuff.
Yeah.
So
you can use those, the conductor tokens or the fundraising tokens. You can use your ability. Your special abilities. You can use your special roll ability, which is flipping the card and it gives you something awesome. For example, the conductor lets you move, gives you 5 moves across different slaves. So
what are
the
6 characters in the game?
There's
six
a preacher,
roles.
Conductor,
shepherd,
agent,
station master,
and then the tax.
And the
was awesome.
Wasn't it the
Stockholder
was great.
And stockholder gives you, like, crazy amounts of money.
Yeah.
But still, the game is challenging. Really challenging. I'll get to that later. And then you can also buy one card. The cards give you different abilities. So they can range for example, buy one token immediately for 3 less money. Move some slaves across the board, several spaces, and whatnot. Or, there are some bad cards that are also seeded into the decks. Those cards are really bad.
Are terrible.
For example, increase the cost of all the tokens, or certain types of tokens, or keep putting slaves into the slave market even more. Which I'm going to get to in a little bit. Once you go through all those phases for every player, then the slave market happens. What you're trying to do is get the slaves out of some plantations. There's set amounts of how many slaves you can have in each plantation. There's a turn order counter, which is a slave market. Those slaves are going to be seeded into the plantations once the whole round goes through and goes to the slave market phase. If any of those slaves cannot fit in the plantations, you just lost them. They're gone. Whatever happened to them, you can imagine.
And that counts for, like, with the game we played, if we lost, like, 21 slaves, we lost the game.
Yeah. If
that
we,
was the losing scenario.
Yes, that is the losing scenario. Pretty much there's a little...
And then if we wanted to play on the hard difficulty, it was if you lost
like
15 slaves.
Jeez.
Yeah, this game has a lot of options for making it harder, and the rule books even say some
Yeah,
options.
you don't even need to make it
so,
harder. The game's already pretty difficult.
So, once the slave market happens, then the lantern phase goes, and you take the rightmost card out... If you didn't use it, and then keep putting cards in into the ones you can buy. There's 6 spots or five?
I think five.
I think, five. Yeah, five spots in order to
three,
buy the car.
3, 2, 2, and 1, 1.
So,
oh, for the amount of money.
Yeah.
And then you move...
The cheaper, the more they go down.
Yeah. Yes. And then you move the lantern to the next player and keep going for 8 rounds. So if you play a 4-player game, each player is going to be first player twice.
Was that game really only 8 rounds?
Yeah. It was.
Wow. That
it is a lot.
Yeah. It's an intense amount of things that you can do within those 8 rounds.
And
that game's very meticulous.
Since
though.
We were talking
it's
about
like a every move you take affects everything.
So
that happens.
Yeah,
if
this,
you mess up, that's bad.
I'll bring this up first. The game is thematic as it gets.
Yeah, that's what I was just gonna say. Just thinking about it, since we were talking about how thematic level 7 was, I was just thinking about Frederick Douglass was in the first time and in the second one, and his card became more powerful in the second one than the first one because times were changing.
Yes.
And obviously the black movement and the support behind them was getting more powerful, so his card became more powerful.
Yes. So, I for example, they put the idea that whenever you move in the area which one of the slave catchers is patrolling, they get a tip, so they move closer. If they go over one of the slaves, it's like they overlooked them. They knew about another slave, and they moved too fast, and the slave just hit. If the person gets money, it means that people are seeing you doing stuff. So they're like, oh, so you're good for the movement. I'm going to give you some money.
Like when you move up to the northern cities.
Yeah, or
yeah, that's really what the
closer.
Support tokens are, too, because you're paying for people to rally
paying
behind
yeah.
the movement.
For the
and,
movement.
And when you get support tokens, it's basically you're trying to get people in the political side to rally even more, and that's why they get more powerful with time.
Which the win condition of the game is, there's different scenarios. Each scenario's got a certain number of slaves you need to escape to Canada, and you must also purchase all of the support tokens from each of the three different time era ages in order by time era.
And finish the round without losing.
And right. I was mistaken. There's not different scenarios. It's just different number of players, right?
Yes. Right.
Yeah, that's all it is. I'm sorry. So
it's a different scenario.
They have different cards. Some cards are only for 3 and 4 players.
Oh, really? Abolitionist cards?
And some of the other time frame cards too.
Oh,
they say 3 and 4 on them.
Yeah.
So
abolitionist cards.
Yeah, and the slave market
gets
the slave market gets weaker if you're like playing solo. But
right.
it's
like it's probably only adding like 4 people at a time.
Yeah,
not like 10 once for us.
So it's oozing with theme. Like every card has fluff. It tells you why it's bad. Like, the bad cards are bad things that actually happened.
And they have historical quotes on them.
Every
single card has quotes. The book is... The instruction book manual is fantastic. At the end, they give you, like, explanations on each of every single card. Also, the last two or three pages...
Talks
they
about
give
the
you,
characters.
Yeah, and they give you, like, an idea of why the movement is important and which characters are important and why. The components are great.
Oh, the components are so good.
The board is beautiful.
Yeah.
Now, I do have to say, the components are wooden cubes.
Yeah. The components are very Euro. Surprisingly.
Very Euro.
A lot of
Academy games are...
Yeah.
But, man, they are so crisp. Like...
Yeah.
I hate cubes.
Yeah.
Chris does not like cubes or Euros. The game does not feel like a Euro game.
No.
But
no.
Each of the slave catchers had symbols, and each of the physical slaves were represented as cubes.
Yes.
So it's, you know, that alone is usually a very common mechanic to Euros.
Yes.
Now, in terms of gameplay, this is possibly one of the tightest games I've played. If you miss one turn or you miscalculate something, it could cost you the game easily.
Yeah, it's a very thin window game. It's like
Ghost Stories, except Ghost Stories, there's randomality added in too.
Yeah.
you screwing up your calculations.
That's the other thing about this game. It's like, wow, there's a random element of the cards being added. The only random element that, like, directly affects the game is the dice roll that changes the movement of the slave catchers. Which, yeah, majority of the game we played, and we lucked out because they just hopped over where we were hiding.
And even if you have, if you see the cards with bad cards, if they're really bad, you have time to react to them.
Right.
So you know exactly what's coming soon.
It's hard.
It's still really hard.
It is a cooperative game.
It is not hard to explain, though. The game, strategically, it's pretty simple to explain and teach to people, but, like, the physical gameplay was, like, the
mechanics of the game is very easy.
Here's your three options. Two are good. One is very good.
Yes.
Lose. Right.
So, in terms of an educational game, it's fantastic. This is losing with theme. If you want to teach someone about the Underground Railroad, this is fantastic. And it's easy to teach. It's easy to learn. But it's still really hard to win. Any other
things we like? Things we dislike?
Things we like. It's historical.
Yes.
And it's awesome.
I'll name things I don't like.
Yeah. So it's historical. I will say.
And I know your reason, and I agree with that.
There's, obviously the game's very different, but when it was first played and first round came, I felt like it was Fury of Dracula. I felt like it was Fury of Dracula, except the board game, the game itself controlled the people trying to catch you, and rather than you being one vampire, you were like 100 vampires. So,
wow, I don't know if that's going to be compared to Fury of Dracula.
Obviously, it's a totally different game, but just like, I think it was just because of the map.
The map.
The map on it,
you know,
looks
not
very,
being Europe,
very...
Is being American.
Yeah,
it
looks very similar to it.
It does.
Like, in
Abraham
how the fact
Lincoln
that the paths interact with each other and how there's different paths. Like,
Abraham Lincoln Vampire Hunter.
It's fine. That's a good analogy.
That used to be a board game. We could just mix freedom and...
So
that's why they're cubes. They can be vampires.
So yeah. Now, the two things that I don't like about it is, even though Jorge explained the theme behind it, I think if the slave catchers were really good at their job, every tile they hit, they would take that slave.
The other thing
I don't like is...
All right, to explain that, though, so you roll the dice, it will show a symbol of one of the slave catchers, and it will show a black or white arrow in a quantity of 1 to 3. And on each location along their routes, it'll have like a black arrow pointing to the east and a white arrow pointing to the west, and then you move that many spaces. What in Chris's circumstances is, when we played, we rolled a lot of move 2 spaces, move 3 spaces. And when they move 3 spaces, everything that they move through, they're kind of just like skipping over because they hopped on a train. So like we maybe had one instance the entire game where an actual slave catcher landed on a space and captured a slave. Like, the rest of the time, they just hopped over them.
It could be rough, though. They could capture 3 potential slaves.
I know.
I
think that should be the point. Like, that is their opportunity to screw everything that you've done. Like,
now if that were to... I mean, I don't see why not. You could do, like, a special rule.
I feel like we'd have to try it in a
I think if we win enough, we can
like,
add
hey,
that
like,
rule.
Yeah.
The game's hard enough,
shot right
as
now.
It is.
And the second thing I don't like about the game is once you realize that there is no hope... There is no point to finishing the game. The first game we played, I think there was 3 rounds left, and there was... You could do the math and look at the moves
there
on the board.
There was still, like...
It wasn't gonna happen.
There was still, like, 10 support tokens to buy.
Right.
It was, like...
So you needed 100 gold, and you still need to get people off the board.
Yeah.
And it was our fault.
Yeah, we were...
We just didn't play it.
It's definitely...
I don't see that happening as much now.
It's definitely something where you can't just, like... Put all your marbles in one basket. You have to be like, okay, we're going to get some across the border, then we're going to buy tokens, then across the border, then buy tokens. Like, you can't just be like, you do this, you do that.
It's an extremely strategic game. There's very little luck in
that game.
Very little luck. So, like, if you guys did that to yourself, you did that to yourself. It's not like you're just, oh, maybe this will come up, and I can roll this, and I'll win. Just maybe.
Yeah, but there's zero luck, so I mean, there's no chance of hope at then. It's just like,
so
the game's done now.
We did get lucky during the first year time frame, though, because we had zero cards that affected the game. Like,
and
the
card draw can affect it.
And the thing is, if we were buying more cards...
That's I don't think we bought any cards the first game.
Yeah, first game we were skipping a lot of cards.
We didn't know what they did.
You have to.
We're like, no, what does this symbol do?
Yeah, okay, whatever it's good.
I don't understand.
Yeah, now that we played it other times, it's like, oh, cards we have to buy the cards. Yeah.
It's how you win. It's how you win is with cards. So that's what you disliked.
Yes.
So you're just doing dislikes?
The other...
I think he explained everything that was...
Okay.
And the other dislike that we had concluded after the game was the presence of an alpha gamer. It is something that if someone's got a alpha gaming personality, they will take over the entire
game. This
can
be the culprit in a lot of co-op games. Co-op games is my favorite genre. Everyone knows that.
Yeah.
My absolute favorite genre. Because,
everybody who listens knows that.
Well, because, I mean, they're very easy to bring to a table and be like, hey, let me explain this game to you. Because I'm not trying to win it. You know, we're trying to win together. So
right.
It's much easier to show...
It's not competitive.
It's not competitive at all. So, but there are some alpha gamers out there, which they will just try and play other people's turns. So, I know Sentinels of the Multiverse is another culprit where that can happen.
Yes.
Yeah.
Like, oh, you need to play this card and this card, and I do this, and you do this, and this card.
Pandemic.
You go over here to... To America,
although,
I'll get these cards. You
Defenders of the Realm is like that.
Now, it can happen in a lot of games. It can happen in tons of games. So,
but it's if you let that alpha male ruin the game for you, you're not really adding input anyway.
Yeah, so at that point in time, you just need to kind of go with the flow. You know, that's why I try and kind of try and say, like, what do you think you need to do? Like, what do you think we should do?
Right.
Instead of just like, oh...
Well, it's also based on your... On your gaming group. I mean, like, our group, we can alpha game each other, and eventually people will kind of just be like, okay, I'm kind of tired, I'll just listen to what you have to say.
Yeah.
But, like, if you were teaching that to new players, like younger players who aren't accustomed to, you know, an hour, hour and a half long, historically based game, they might be like, well, I'm not really doing anything. I'm kind of just, like, picking up the tokens and putting them where you tell me to, and then I just move where I go, you know? It's like...
Yeah, that's where you, as a facilitator of a game, should be like, what do you think you should do?
Yeah.
Right.
Which, or, you know, there's players that just don't care about that period.
Which, anything about this, you can always reference podcast number one, because we had a whole segment talking about the goods and the bads of hosting and playing board games. Continuing about the game, though.
Cool. Well, things we like. Components.
Double it's components,
awesome.
Yes.
Triple components. Everything. Card
and
quality.
The Kickstarter Lantern was pretty awesome.
For Kickstarter user... the people at Kickstarter, they also got a Kickstarter lantern.
It looks like a diecast lantern. It looks like a dollhouse lantern.
Yeah. And another one expansion pack, which has Quakers, for example.
Yeah, I'm curious how that would work. That's really interesting. The fact that they add, like, an element, like, I don't know. The Quakers sound just really cool, like, how they'd integrate with that.
Well, they would bring
concept.
Delicious oatmeal. to everyone.
Are they bribing the slave catchers with oatmeal?
With oatmeal, yeah.
You do not move for two turns.
So, mechanics in the game, very unique stuff, actually.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, it's not a push cube game, because, like, you have to take specific tokens to be able to move guys.
It's kind of like Dominant Species. Like, Dominant Species... Obviously, it's competitively, but if you took that competitive element out of Dominant Species, that's kind of how it ran. Like, rather than us competing on who gets the actions, we work as a group to choose among those actions that are available.
Yeah.
Like, in a side pool that you eventually use in your turn.
The card mechanic where things are more expensive, like, farther out, you know, like...
Yeah.
That's actually used by a couple different games, and it's used very well in this game. Like, one game that uses it very well is 8-Minute Empire. Has anyone played 8-Minute Empire?
I need to play it, so...
Game's great. But anyway, like, cards come out. They're more expensive right then when they come out. And the longer they've been out, the cheaper they are.
Right.
Just like in that game. I love that mechanic, because it's really cool. Because it's a, man, is this card really worth it? Me spending this much on it? Should I just wait till here? But it might be too late if I wait till there. Oh gosh, what's going to happen? Is everyone going to die? So...
I like the theme of the game.
I love the communication between everyone.
You have to communicate. Completely essential in this game.
Well, you could not, and you would just lose really quickly.
You would
see the 8-minute freedom.
Freedom! Not anymore!
And other things I like is you're not just doing one goal. You're doing two goals. You completely forget about one of the goals.
You're not even doing two. You're doing three.
Yeah.
Oh, what else is really cool is that even though you get your own, like, sheet, so you are a character, you don't have a pawn on the board. You're just, you're influencing America.
Right.
Which is pretty cool.
So, the historical quality of that game is so gorgeous.
So, I really like the support token area. It's like, oh, we have to buy this to do our political movement, but we're trying to also save these people. Don't forget about that.
I took the rule book from Jorge twice to make sure that's actually how he won. Because I was like, this is ridiculous.
yeah, it says it there.
I was like, crap.
Well,
ratings.
Let's
we'll
lead
go
into our 1 to 10. Oh, we're going to reverse it?
Might as well. I'm not always going to start.
I like it when we reverse it. So.
I figured Jorge would start. It says game.
Yeah, Jorge.
No, we'll leave Jorge to last.
Okay.
You know, since he began it, he will end it.
Okay.
So
we're going to go in like a diamond shape.
Yeah, we'll kind of do like a, you know, hopscotch.
Okay.
So, my rating of the game, I'm actually going to give it an 8.5. Components are gorgeous. The gameplay was complex, easy to explain, and a total blast to play. Thematically, perfect. Historical games, right up my alley. Made in Ohio. There you go. You get your point score. Great game.
I'm going to give it an 8. It's really good. It's full of theme. It's super, super easy to sit down, and after one turn, you pretty much got it. And they did a good job. So 8.
I will also give it an 8. Definitely. Great theme, great mechanics. Really, like, once you play one turn, you really get it. Reason why mine's not a little bit higher is that it might not be a game that every single group's going to love.
Right. Well, it's a historical
game. It's a historical game.
Yeah.
So, you know, historical games have that select crowd. It's very good. This would probably be a game you want to work into people like, hey, you want to try something different?
Right.
Yeah, definitely. So,
So I'm going to give 2 ratings for one reason. They want to teach people also because they're going to give it to the Freedom Center.
Ah,
so
educational.
As a game, I'm going to give it an 8. It's fantastic. As a, just the game, the theme is great. You actually feel like you're working for a goal, and when you finish that goal, you feel awesome. As an educational game, I'm gonna give it a 9.
Almost a 10.
Well,
it's really good.
Well,
educationally, it is spot on.
Yeah.
Like, if you really wanna teach the Underground Railroad to someone, this is it.
Yeah, like, I want this whooped out.
I don't.
That would be awesome.
Yeah, I don't think there's... If anyone wants to touch the Underground Railroad in a board game, I don't think you should.
Game made on that theme, there's no other game that needs to be made about that theme that was spot on. Like,
because it was done very well. I mean, on a very, very hard time in our country, really.
Yeah, done by a
very,
you know, a smaller company
that
has focused a lot on more like, you know, United States historical themes and Ohio themes. But on that note, that is our review of Freedom. We're now going to lead into our closing notes. Thanks, everybody, for listening tonight. In approximately 1 month, we will be posting another podcast with a similar length with 2 board game reviews, which we will eventually announce on the Facebook, probably halfway there. As a collective whole, we're a little bit torn on what we should cover and review. If you have any suggestions, you can always post them to the Facebook. You can always message myself, Chris, Jorge, or Ryan, or you can go ahead and email us at cleancutcasual@gmail.com. I'm Ethan Schultz.
Chris Bettinger.
I'm Jorge Lasses.
Ryan Hicks.
Have a good night, everybody.